Got a question for you. Why live if you can be buried for $10?
I had very logical reasons for believing in things that logic and reason could never teach me. It's kind of ironic, but the more complexity science finds in life, the less likely becomes the whole scenario and theory they use to explain its origin. The really amazing thing is that quantum physics shows that nature, at its most fundamental level, strains human credulity and knowledge in ways biblical faith never does.
Hi, Cliff Goldstein here. Welcome to the program. 2 days before World War I ended, Pablo Picasso, then almost 40 years old, was in the bathroom of the Hotel Lucia in Paris when the phone rang. When Picasso picked it up, sound waves from the receiver beat onto his eardrum the news that his great friend, the poet William Guillaume Apollinaire, excuse my French, his great friend had died. Weakened by a head wound in the battlefield, Apollinaire succumbed to the Spanish flu, which would end up killing more people than the whole war ended up killing. COVID's bad, but man, it didn't kill people like the Spanish flu did. It was a rough time back then, too. We came out of the First World War devastated, millions dead, millions injured, only to get blasted by the Spanish flu, which killed, as I said, even more people than the war itself did. Anyway, Picasso looked up, the phone still against his ear. And in a biography of Picasso, Arianna Huffington wrote, his terrified expression in the mirror shocked him. And his instinctive immediate response was to draw his self-portrait with that undisguised look of mortality he had seen staring at him back. According to Huffington, Picasso kept that self-portrait for many years, not wanting anybody to see the expression splattered across it. Now, if you've ever seen that picture, if get a chance, Google Picasso self-portrait facing death. Woo! It is haunting. Continued Huffington, she wrote. She said, for Picasso, who feared mortality as the single most horrifying fact of existence, that death at the unnatural age of 39 of the man he had been so close, who he had so closely shared the last 14 years of his life, was an agonizing fact, an agonizing shock. Picasso, fearing death as the most horrifying act of existence. Well, you know, that's kind of a paradox, because death is the essence of non-existence. We often hear the phrase about someone dead, she's gone, he's gone. It really kind of fits too, in the sense of the absoluteness of death. We've all experienced this. I mean, these people, they're here, they're talking, they're laughing, they're doing what living people do. And then, boom, gone, non-existence. It's just, boom, it's the ultimate contradiction. It's a hard thought for us to grasp, especially for ourselves. Who doesn't shudder at the thought of their own non-existence, of their own non-being? It seems like a contradiction, like a formal logic problem. If A, then not A. Law of contradiction kind of thing. I want to use this Picasso story to lead into something else, a Bible text. It's from the book of Hebrews, and it was written long ago by many believe by Paul. As usual, Paul is talking about Jesus, and he's talking about Paul, and he's talking about Jesus coming into humanity. You know, we get so used to talking about Jesus, then we can forget how amazing his coming here is. I mean, the creator of the, try to grasp this, the creator of the cosmos, the creator of all that was created, of all that once didn't exist, that but then came into existence, all these galaxies, he became a human being and he lived among us and then died among us. I mean, how do we wrap our minds around this? Again, this is the essence of Christianity. God came to us, shrank down, and took upon himself our humanity. The one who, according to Genesis, and breathed into Adam, and the Lord God formed man out of the dust of the ground and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and man became a living being. This same Lord God then allowed himself to be made of the same dust of the ground as we are. You often hear the saying, if it sounds too good to be true, it's probably not. Well, in this case, it is true. And anyway, here is what Paul, almost two millennia ago, wrote. Talking about Jesus, he said this. He said, since the children have flesh and blood, he too shared in their humanity. Again, this is the creator. This is God. He too shared in their humanity so that by his death, he might destroy him who holds the power of death. That is the devil. And free those who all their lives were held in slavery by their fear of death. Oof, there's a mouthful here. But I want to focus just on the theme of death, 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 which we just saw so haunted Picasso. He's talking here about death, but about destroying him who has the power of death. Now, without getting into a whole lot here, because frankly, I don't fully understand everything he's saying, but I think I know enough to understand that death is of the devil. Death is evil. Death is wrong. You know, you want to talk about why evolution is so contrary to the Bible. In evolution, death becomes a necessity. It becomes the means of life, okay? The weaker die off and the stronger live on. Yet it's the opposite. It's opposite of the whole tenor of the Bible. Death is the enemy. Think about this. We were beings who were never meant to die. Okay? Can you grasp that idea? We were beings who were never meant to die. And I think that's why we so hate death, because it's so opposite of everything we were made for. But that is a radically different concept from how life itself presents itself to us. It's a radically different concept because, look, we live in a fallen world, okay? So all we know is death, 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 death. We take it for granted. We take it as natural, but it's the most unnatural act there is. You know, a while back, I went to a funeral of a friend of mine. His name was Burnell Baldwin. And after the service, I went up to the gravesite, and I'll never forget this. I walk up this hill, they call it Resurrection Hill, And I go to this grave, and I go up, and there are these graves there and tombstones. And then there's where he's buried. And I could tell he had just been put in the ground because there was this rectangular thing of dirt, you know, a little more than 6 feet, 7 feet, just the dirt, the upturned earth. And around it was the green grass. And then there was this just this rectangle of death. And it just hit me. You know, the thought of this man, so full of life, so full of what the French call the joie de vivre, the vivre of energy. Energy, he was alive, this and that, and suddenly here he was in the dirt, laying there in the ground. It was surreal. And then it hit me that death is as real as life itself. Okay. Yet, as I said, we were beings originally created to live forever. Of course, we don't even get close to that, do we? I mean, if we lived another 10,000 years in contrast to eternity, there's almost no difference between that and our 60s, 60, 70, 80 years. And so what is Paul saying here? Since the children have flesh and blood, since we are flesh and blood, he too, God too, shared in their humanity, that by death he might destroy him who holds the power of death. Destroy the power of death. That is the devil. And free those who all their lives were held in slavery by the fear of death. And you know, what's he basically saying? He's saying that because of Jesus, we no longer have to fear death. We no longer have to be enslaved by death. And I think, you know, what he means is that if you really think about it, and I've covered this theme before, death is the great nullifier. You know, we sometimes talk about death as the great equalizer. Kings, peasants, they all wind up in the same place. But if you really think about it, death is the great nullifier. No, no, no. And before death, we are all, you, me, everyone, kings, princes, whatever, we are all equally null and void. Before death, our lives are equally of no value, of no long-term purpose. In the long run, Hitler, Mother Teresa, they all wind up in the same meaningless abyss of eternal nothingness, eternal destruction, eternal death. And people know this. You know, I can't tell you, oh my goodness, I can't tell you how much literature I have read over the decades of smart people, sensitive people, people looking around and bemoaning the reality of their own death and what it means for them and what it means for their families and what it means for their friends and what it means for their life. I mean, before death, everything that comes before seems so utterly fruitless and purposeless. You know, I mean, life itself, at times, life itself can be hard enough. Can be a real bummer, okay? And then you get to die for eternity afterwards. You know, Elizabeth Wurtzel wrote Prozac Nation, Young and Depressed in America, and it took the literary world by storm in 1994 with her memoir about, well, being young and depressed in America. And ultimately, she told how Prozac helped her. It's a powerful read. And it's, you know, it's one of those who, you know, who that could help others realize that when you see somebody depressed, say, come on, just suck it up. Come on, get a, you know, stiff upper lip and all that. Well, when you got people suffering from clinical depression, You know, it's like telling somebody with multiple myeloma, you know, take two aspirin and call back in the morning. But anyway, in this book, she wrote this line about her time in camp before attempting suicide. She writes, "I couldn't imagine why I was being coerced into all those activities anyway. The roll motion of Newcomb, kickball, soccer, the breaststroke, making lanyards, all this regimented activity that seemed meant only to pass a little more time as we headed inexorably towards death. Even then, I was pretty certain in my almost 12-year-old mind that life was one long distraction from the inevitable." And what was the inevitable? Yes, death. I mean, look, you don't need to be young and depressed in America to see the powerful logic of her words. More than one person has wondered about the meaning and purpose of our lives, full of pain, full of suffering, full of toil, full of trouble, that always and without exception end in death. You know, I can remember I had my first sense of existentialist dread. My first one, I was about 14 years old. It would have been the mid-1960s. And I remember I was laid out on a sofa in our living room, and I'm reading a Time magazine, and I'm reading about all the nuclear missiles the Americans had aimed at the Soviets and all the nuclear missiles that the Soviets had aimed at us. And I just knew, I mean, as I laid there, I knew in my cynical self, I knew that sooner or later, we were going to annihilate each other. Whether it was an accident, whatever it was, one day, kaboom, we were going to get nuked and everything would vanish in a mushroom cloud. And I can still remember laying on that sofa, wondering, what am I going to school for? What am I going to, you know, junior high, what am I going to go to high school for? What, you know, because even if it takes 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, sooner or later, kaboom. And even if we don't nuke each other 10, 20, 30, whatever number of years, kaboom, either way, we're still going to be just as dead as whether we got nuked. And it all just made me think, what is the purpose of it? You know, along this lines, I read a story. I read a man in India who sued his parents. He was a follower of something called antinatalism, natal as in birth. And he teaches that it's morally wrong for people to procreate and to bring children in the world, because to be born means to suffer and to die. And he claimed that his parents selfishly brought him into the world, and therefore his parents were obligated to take care of him for the rest of his life. Let me read you. He goes, "I want everybody in India and in the world to realize the one thing, that they are born without their consent. I want them to understand that they do not owe their parents anything. If we are born without our consent, we should be maintained for our life. We should be paid by our parents to live." Okay. Well, all right. You know, it's kind of warped, I agree. But, you know, there's a little bit of logic, man. I didn't ask to be born. I don't imagine any of you folks listening, you asked to be born too. Okay. Reminded me of this novel I read by an Israeli. The novel is called A Horse Walks Into a Bar. And author David Grossman has a stand-up comedian. It's a book about a stand-up comedian. And anyway, here's what the comedian says, okay? "Exactly at this moment, more or less, in the old Hadassah Hospital in Jerusalem, my mother, Sarah Greenstein, went into labor. Unbelievable, isn't it? A woman who claimed to want only the best for me, and yet she gave birth to me. I mean, think about how many trials and prisons and investigations and crime there are because of murder. But I've yet to hear of a single case involving birth. Nothing about premeditated birth, negligent birth, accidental birth, not even an incitement to birth. And don't forget, we're talking about a crime where the victim is a minor. Okay, well, again, that's not how we look at it, but there's certain logic to this. There was an advertisement in an American magazine in the 20s or something that fascinated Sigmund Freud. Freud and his obsession with death. And the advertisement said, "Why live if you can be buried for 10 bucks?" Oh, I love it. Good old American capitalism. Americans are going to make money off of you on anything. Anyway, now, this pessimism really, however, makes sense if and only if you accept the premise so simply expressed by Carl Sagan, the late and very dead Carl Sagan, I might ask, who said, "The cosmos is all that there is or ever was or will be." Okay? This is the idea that the creation is sufficiently self-explanatory and that it alone explains itself without need of a creator. Okay? Let me quote this again, that the cosmos is all that there ever is or ever will be. You know, that's quite a bold statement. I mean, first of all, think about who's saying it, okay? Okay, the who is saying it. Yes, the what, a single human being, a tiny transient speck of complicated biological mass existing on a planet so small in contrast to the cosmos he is talking about. In other words, our brains, as purely physical entities, are quite small in contrast to the size of the cosmos that these brains claim to know so much about. And it's with these brains, or his brain, that Carl Sagan and others like them interact and think about the cosmos. And I suppose if you took all the other brains out there, that you put them together, that might be a lot of brain power, but what is all that in contrast to the size of the cosmos? In other words, my point is that Carl Sagan's statement, "The cosmos is all that is or ever was or ever will be," even if it were true, reflects such incredible hubris. How could he possibly know that? How could he possibly know that? This is a purely philosophical statement. It's a statement of great extrapolation and conjecture based on a whole bunch of unproven assumptions. I mean, we barely understand the cosmos itself, how it got here, why it's here, why it does what it does. In fact, scientists think that 92% of the universe is made of something called dark matter and dark energy, which means that the 8% that's before us, that we see with our telescopes and math formulas, that's only 8%. And yet he could claim that the cosmos is all that is or ever was or ever will be. It's not a scientific statement. It's a bold pronouncement of atheistic materialism. And not only is it unwarranted by the facts, it's really kind of silly as well. And not just because of a lot of speculation, but it's very illogical as well. I mean, if the cosmos itself is a temporal entity, then it somehow it would have, and purely material, it would have had to have created itself, and it would have had to sustain itself. But how does something create itself? If the cosmos is all that there is, then there's nothing outside the cosmos. Then the cosmos would have to have created itself out of nothing. And the idea of the universe as something self-explanatory, that its origins can be found in and of itself, that makes about as much sense as saying the origins of a chess game could be found in and of itself as well. You know, the bottom line here is that if that seems implausible for a chessboard to have created itself, how much more so the cosmos, which is much more bigger and much more complicated expression of the same elements. It does, you know, of the chessboard. It doesn't make sense. No wonder then how many people find the atheistic scientific explanations of origins logically, spiritually, and intellectually unsatisfying. But I come back to that text, since the children have flesh and blood, he too shared in their humanity, so that by his death he might destroy him who holds the power of death. That is the devil. And free those who all their lives were held in slavery by death. This text points to a reality. It points to a reality so much greater than the materialistic world that Carl Sagan and these others point to. And it points to a world in which God, the God not only created everything, but this God sustains it, and this God is going to redeem it as well. Because God created space, time, matter, energy, he created all things, and he's a reality so much greater and different from all those things. And he has promised us in Jesus, we who are temporal beings, we who in and of ourselves, we're going to die and it's all going to be meaningless. Through Jesus on the cross, he has showed that it's just a temporary thing. We just sleep in the ground. And the power who created the cosmos, who sustains the cosmos, who holds every atom, this is the same God who did that. He certainly's got the power to free us from death. And that's the great promise of Jesus on the cross.